Hi everyone, my name is Liz Vu and I'm a program associate at the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak at FOSDEM and share with you about my recent exploration into the design needs of scientific open source software. And I'll share a bit more about the Sloan Foundation, specifically the technology program later, but for now I wanted to dive right into the questions I have top of mind when I think about design, usability, and overall user experience of scientific open source. So the most pertinent question I have, as someone who works in philanthropy and as someone who really cares about the healthy ecosystem of open tools used in science, is the question of when. When to invest in the UX of scientific open source. Since Sloan funds basic research in the sciences, we are naturally inclined to think about the scientific open source, but I'm also interested in this question for open source more generally. In contrast, I have a pretty good idea of why it's worth investing in the UX of scientific open source, and I'll go a bit into that a little later. I also have a good sense of how to invest in the UX of scientific open source, and that's because Sloan has had a long history, several decades, in fact, of grant making, and we have a pretty good idea of the kinds of activities that are worth funding. However, there's always room for exploration, experimentation, and learning, so that's why I also have a question mark here. I have a good idea how, but I have a feeling there's more to consider. Where I'm looking for the most guidance, though, is the question on when to invest, and the motivations for why I'm interested in understanding when is because I recognize that not all open source projects are the same, and that requires understanding of unique contexts. And I'm also interested in understanding contexts in a way that informs prioritization. And ultimately, the goal is to best identify opportunities where Sloan support can ultimately help broaden access and really maximize impact. And before I go on, I also wanted to end on the who question. And that's where I'm most excited to talk to all of you who have been thinking about open source design for a long time, and to talk to you to get a sense of who you think can best inform and who you think can best advise on the questions that I lay out today. So to share more about why investing in UX is important, we know that software is increasingly important to science. You'd be hard-pressed to find a scientist or a team who doesn't use it for even the most basic applications like LibreOffice or other mainstream tools, to more collaborative platforms like Jupyter, to the more complex and specialized systems that are typically designed and written by scientists. And if you don't quite intuit that, just follow the money. The NSF over a period of 10 years has made more than 18,000 awards totaling about $10 billion US dollars related to research software. And about 20% of that of NSF projects discussed software in their abstracts, and about 33% of research now produces new code. And what all that points to is that the idea that both software development and its usage are essential activities for scientific teams. Scientists themselves are increasingly touching software, even if they're novices or if they consider themselves more competent practitioners or expert developers. It's not strange at all to see software feature in a day in the life of a scientist. But we also know that investment in software production, software maintenance, and efforts to increase adoption is often overlooked. Funding, especially in the sciences, doesn't always name software as the primary output or as a first-rate research output. And software becomes a thing where it's kind of like a nice-to-have as part of funded projects. One does not simply plan for software. It's usually a byproduct of the funded research. And I'm not saying this is an ideal thing, but it's the state of things. And the consequences for this type of funding environment are many. There's a lack of focus on research software being fair, like findable, accessible, interoperable, reproducible. There's also a lack of attention on software as a first-rate academic output in a way that creates this space that doesn't recognize or elevate software skills and knowledge. And so the labor that goes into sustaining research software goes pretty unrewarded. All in all, these factors point to an unsustainable environment. So I've come to the current understanding that in our current state, academia often fails to leverage best practices for software engineering from industry, the open source community, or elsewhere. And it's from this community, the open source community, that I've learned that open source is more than just a licensing option. It's a set of practices in peer production. So I think there are some transferable lessons for academia based on maybe some of the overlapping themes that you see between these two communities. So scientific software stands to benefit from the learnings and current practices in open source design. And there are a few ways I can think of which I think there could be lessons heeded, lessons learned from you all who have, you know, been participating in open source for a while. And for one, we recognize that when it comes to labor, there are complex configurations here, but there is significant unpaid volunteer labor, the kind of invisible labor and by folks whose principles serve as the motivation to volunteer. From this being the case in open source, the lesson academics can learn is to be wary of burnout in these situations. Second, there's this case about expectations of maintenance, especially when a piece of software becomes something like infrastructure, something that is often taken for granted. And there are implicit assumptions about security and the secure use of that software. The lesson to heed here is for academics to be wary of catastrophic success where a piece of software unintentionally gets picked up by the community at large and sets up these new expectations about maintenance. And lastly, a lesson academics can learn is to consider the user, because we have platforms now that can easily host feedback and catalog issues in a public way. And, you know, obvious example is GitHub. It's now possible to set these platforms up to better collect feedback and understand user needs. So the lesson to be learned here for academics is to pay attention to any potential scientist adopter or community adopter for the software you're developing. Of course, there are already scientific open source communities that are heeding those lessons and behaving really healthily. And I've provided some examples of Sloan grantees here, Jupyter, NumPy, Frictionless Data, and the Journal of Open Source Software, who've successfully navigated the scale-up of their projects to be thriving entities that have mechanisms for contributions. But if I were to think about the larger subset of scientific software, I'd bet that the reality is that UX is treated more as an afterthought, if considered at all. And really, who can blame them? It's quite easy for that to be the case. It's quite easy for me to think of a typical scenario of how this came to be, like a scientist in a lab writing a piece of software for themselves. And they assume they're going to be the only users of that software, and they're pretty much the power user. And both of those roles, developer and power user, are one and the same person. But it doesn't have to be quite like that, right? There's a project lifestyle that, for those of you in industry, may recognize, and this is your day-to-day, but the design process of understanding, ideating, prototyping, testing, and repeating all that. What if this framework were intrinsically embedded within every scientific project's lifestyle? Is that an ideal future to work towards? I'm not quite sure of the right answer to this question, but that's okay. I'm That's why I'm exploring. I'm continuing to explore this question of when it makes sense to deploy this life cycle in different types of scientific projects. So let's go back to the statement. What I said was the current state, which is that academia often fails to leverage best practices for software engineering from the open source community. Or more specifically, scientific software stands to benefit from the learnings and current practices in open source design. As such, any future investment in UX is expected to have a disproportionately positive impact on adoption of scientific tools. And I'm thinking about broadening access, and it would have a disproportionately positive impact on scientific discovery itself. This is the future state that I wonder can be true, but currently the impact of this kind of investment or lack thereof is largely unknown, unquantified. So that's all about the why of investing in scientific open source. Let's talk about the how, and really what the Sloan Foundation Technology Program does. Broadly, the foundation makes grants primarily to support original research and education related to science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and economics. The technology program supports the development of technologies, but also the shaping of their broader social and institutional contexts, so that institutions and communities have the ability to create and share scientific knowledge at scale. But if that's all hard to remember of what we do, just, you know, a really relevant takeaway here is that the technology program provides direct support for better software. The technology program has two sub-programs, Better Software for Science and the Exploratory Program. Under each are a few focus areas. We support open source research. We also think about software publication and archiving, and we want to support the careers of people who create and maintain software. There are also several other foci under the Exploratory Program, and I invite you to check out our website to read more on these. But when it comes directly to technology development, we are cognizant of the many stages a project may face. Scoping, prototyping, piloting, scaling, and sustainability. We consider the stages at Sloan, where Sloan support makes most sense. And some of the types of outputs that we see in the grants are not just, you know, code releases or product releases, but also efforts towards maintaining those code repositories or documentation, a set of user stories, user journeys, and data sets. We also support grants, which are about institutions, often though not exclusively universities, to really pilot organizational innovation and to build new capacities. Grants in this category also support critical network building, and they facilitate community. And here are two examples of grantees of ours who support the communities of practitioners that coalesce around development, support, maintenance, or adoption of discovery-enhancing technologies. And that's the Center for Scientific Collaboration and Community Engagement and the Maintainers. Another type of grant we support is about training, and aiming to develop new skills in existing professionals and thinking about growing the ranks of new professional roles. An example grantee in this category are the carpentries, which, you know, comprise of data carpentry, and software carpentry, and others. And this group supports excellent training programs for better data and software literacy. The last category of grant I'll talk about is the research grant, which supports academic researchers who use historical or ethnographic or economic methods to identify unmet researcher needs in the digital age. Thus far, we've provided one grant in the area of UX and scientific open source, and that was in this category, a research style grant. And I'll share a bit more about that grant in a bit, but I wanted to walk through the one question a little bit more. So when is it best to invest in the UX of scientific open source? To partially get to this question, we must think about the typology of scientific open source projects based on the characteristics of the projects themselves. So I draw an inspiration from this diagram here, which is from Nadia Egbo's book, Working in Public. Here we see a 2x2 matrix, which describes the categories that open source projects fall under. And so you can see those categories are high or low user growth or high or low contributor growth. And under each of those kind of intersections, you'll see open source projects classified. And so an example is for a high user growth and high contributor growth, those are called federation style projects, or small user growth or small contributor growth are classified as toys. So scientific open source falls across this matrix as well, of course, but it's unknown to me what the distribution is. And that, you know, would be one of the first things I'd spend time classifying to just gain that better nuanced contextual understanding. And after getting a better idea of that distribution and the characteristics of different projects, the hope is that we have a framework to understand how to prioritize projects. You know, understand what are the most important project types to invest in UX-wise, and what projects might it not matter as much for. And when it comes to making sure investments in UX are impactful and broad in access, there's also the question of whether peer production platforms like GitHub or GitLab are naturally set up such that designers are supported and good UX practices are supported. It's unclear to me how these platforms currently set up a way for good design to just naturally live and interact with the platform, and whether they configure the tools so that if you're using something like Figma or Penpot, then you know that naturally flows into the larger peer production platforms like GitHub or GitLab. I'll leave that as an open question here, an open question to poke at as we consider all the aspects of this problem space. But I did think about it when thinking about this, just the wide scale application of the findings that we invest in. And then in the final minutes here, I just want to share more about the two researchers who I mentioned before that we supported through a grant awarded last year. So Jin Guo of McGill and Jingwei Cheng of the Polytechnique Montreal Technical University. They're studying a particular type of scientific open source. So if you revisit that 2x2 matrix, the type of project that they're really studying is that federation category, the high user growth, high contributor growth category. And their grant will be studying how to better understand user needs in this category by soliciting the most high quality, best usability feedback that comes in through peer production platforms. So, you know, a way you can think about this feedback coming in is in, you know, GitHub issues or the various threads in which you can interact with project maintainers on GitHub. And so their goal is to really figure out how to best solicit that feedback, and even doing some of that automatically. They have expertise in natural language processing, and they're hoping to streamline some of that and prompt some of that. You can see in one of their earlier studies that they've been working on some foundational knowledge buildings to inform their future work. And one of their earlier studies here, you can see that they've been able to classify the type of feedback that exist in GitHub issues. And so you can kind of see that spread for the kinds of things that you see in the discussion, in the textual discussion. And an example is that solution discussion. So that orange blob, you know, a third of the way down this graph, really shows the prevalence of how people discuss solutions right away throughout throughout the their feedback, which tells me a little bit something about the nature of what's communicated, even if that might not be the best thing for maintainers to see. But yeah, there's more to unpack here, I'm sure.